issues, etc. Here in the second hour, continuing our conversation on Islam, broadcasting live from the Symposia at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. Dr. Alvin Schmidt is our guest, along with Dr. Adam Francisco. Before the break, we had Sarah on the line. She had asked about the Islamic writings, and then she also had a question regarding the relationship between this present Pope Benedict XVI, which has been very rocky early in his pontificate, to reaching out toward Muslim scholars of every stripe to have some sort of a conversation. Dr. Schmidt, is this a worthwhile endeavor on the part of Benedict XVI?
Knowing the history of Islam, I will say it would be utter failure, or unless the Pope totally capitulates. He's not going to make any advances with them in terms of what he's already said, unless he totally apologizes, which to some extent he already has, I would argue. So, no, I don't see anything good coming out of that. In fact, it'll probably be propaganda that'll come out to the Muslims' benefit, given the politically correct media that we have, which is sort of pro-Islam and anti-Christianity. So I can't see any good coming out. That's my prediction, and I would even bet on it.
Do you expect the actual conference of these, and some hundreds, some scholars who've written a letter to the Pope asking to meet with him, do you expect it to take place?
Well, I suppose, given that the papacy is a political office as well as a theological office, it will probably take place in some form or fashion. I would be surprised if it were totally canceled, because I think the Pope's got himself in a bind. He is sort of, if I may use the vernacular, damned if he doesn't, and damned if he does and does. He's really in a tight jacket, so to speak.
What do you think, Dr. Francisco, about the meeting? Do you think it could be fruitful in some sense?
In some sense, maybe temporally, but theologically, absolutely not. But it might help sort of ease some of the tensions. But still, they're working with a false image of Islam. You know, Islam is being sold as this moderate, privatized religion. And that's the assumption by a lot of people. They assume that that's what it is, but that is not it. Islam is not, it's not just a religion that's, you know, a private affair. It's a very political thing. And so when you underestimate the power and the all-encompassing ideology of Islam, I think you're doomed in the long term to failure. You're damned if you do, damned if you don't, as Dr. Schmidt says.
We're giving away the free pamphlet called What About Islam to our callers, 1-800-730-2727, 505-7850, and to those who email questions and comments, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Let's talk with Mike, who's listening in Kansas City. Mike, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Yeah, good afternoon, Pastor. I wish everyone listening would consider supporting Issues, Etc. through the Reformation Club. It's a great resource. And, gentlemen, I really appreciate your expertise on this. Something I found kind of interesting, and it seems to be a common denominator, has to do with being descendants of Abraham. And I know that that's mentioned in the Quran, and also many people who defend the Jewish nation of Israel as being also descendants of Abraham. But didn't Christ address this directly in the Gospels, especially I believe it's the Gospel of John, where the religious leaders of the day are referring to themselves as being, also descendants of Abraham and worshiping the God of Abraham? And Christ basically said to them, if you worship the true God of Abraham, then you would know that I am. Why is it that evangelicals and people who support, this notion can't understand that particular scripture?
It's a good question, Mike, and thank you very much for listening in Kansas City. Dr. Francisco, your response.
Oh boy, that's a big question.
Well, first of all, let's deal with the historical matter.
Yep.
Is it in fact true that the not all adherents, but those of Arabic descent are in fact genealogically descendants of Abraham?
Through Ishmael, they even before Islam, the Arabs saw themselves as descendants of Ishmael.
Then let's deal with the theological aspect, which is more to the heart of Mike's question. At least from Jesus' perspective, who are the descendants of Abraham?
Those who have faith in Christ. There's another one I really like is in Luke, the parable of, I think it's Lazarus and mm-hmm. the rich man, where they go down to Hades, and you have the rich man and Lazarus are separated. The rich man sees that Lazarus is he's at the side of Abraham, right? And then the rich man calls out. He says, "Father Abraham." Father Abraham, and he's shunned, even though he claims himself to be a follower of Abraham or a descendant of Abraham. He doesn't have faith in Christ.
I had never even thought of that before.
Even if you claim, just because you say you follow Abraham's religion, Abraham's deen, as the Muslims would say, doesn't mean you do.
Here's a question from Ken here in the audience. He says, we frequently hear that Muslims respect Christians as quote-unquote people of the book. You used that term before, I believe. Yet doesn't this quote actually, isn't it one actually of condemnation, since they teach that Christians have changed the words of Jesus? First you, Dr. Francisco, and then a chance for Dr. Schmidt to respond too.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you read any time in the later passages of the Quran, when the people of the book are mentioned, it's always, not always, most of the time it's associated with this conquering the people of the book. And usually the Arabic term qital is used, which means smite or destroy the people of the book, unless they submit to Islam.
So that's a qualified statement, people of the book.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Dr. Schmidt?
Yeah, I fully agree. And what often isn't recognized is that submit is ultimately the word of Islam. That's what Islam means. And it's not a religion of peace. You know, there is the thing that I've mentioned sometime before, the Islamic doctrine of abrogation. Before he went to Medina, 622, he tried to gain followers, and he didn't get too many over a period of about 8 years, from about 613, 614 to 622. He tried to get them by means of persuasion. After he took the Hijra to Medina, he now changed his tactics. And all the passages that have sort of quasi-peace context to them have been abrogated by the more recent passages, and that's the principle spelled out in the Quran itself, that the more, if there are a contradiction between one or two more passages, the more recent ones abrogate, annul, if you will, the earlier passage. These are all the so-called peace passages. And so that's basically where the doctrine of abrogation. They're still in the Quran, but they're no longer valid. And
so you have to read the Quran from beginning to end to figure out what the real message is. And really, the message at the end is the definitive written in stone message of the Quran.
Right. And some of the good translations will tell you which given chapter or surah where it was written, at Mecca or Medina. And if they're written in Medina, they're all more recent than the earlier ones at Mecca.
Yeah. Okay. This raises a concern that I have, because you mentioned before that Islam sometimes, especially in the West, tries to sell itself. I think the term you used was moderate private religion or moderate private spirituality. And just last night, I was out on my it wasn't last night. It must have been the night before, because I was in the car last night. One of those nights recently, I was out on my walk. I was listening to one of my favorite radio programs, and they were doing a feature on an Islamic family here in the United States. And some of the and really just sad persecution and torment that a little Islamic girl had suffered at her school at the hands of some of her teachers and the other students. It was kind of heart-wrenching. Here is this mother in tears over her daughter being mistreated as a Muslim, being misunderstood from her perspective as a Muslim. Here is this mother unable to explain that this religion that she had converted to because she married a Muslim man that her daughter was raised in isn't what Osama bin Laden is practicing. And your heart goes out to such people. I'm between a rock and a hard place. I'm saying to myself, have I been too hard on Islam? Have I misunderstood it? Here is a perfectly reasonable woman who wants to harm no one in the name of Islam, believes that she is truly following the dictates of the Quran and of the Prophet, and yet in juxtaposition to that is the vast majority of Islam that is very much the stereotype, living up to it every day. How do I reconcile these two things? I want both of your answers, Dr. Francisco.
I usually make a distinction between Islam and Muslims. You know, in Christianity, you have people who call themselves Christians who are willing to deny, you know, that Christ rose from the dead and things like that, but they still call themselves Christians. Are they Christians? No, but they still call themselves Christians. And in the Islamic world, I think it's the same way. You have a whole bunch of Muslims out there who call themselves Muslims but don't really believe all the tenets of the Islamic faith. So I make a distinction between Islam, and you can get what Islam is from reading the Quran. It's very clear. The message is very clear that this is a It's an austerely monotheistic religion, but it's not just a religion. It's also a political ideology, if you will. But then you have all these Muslims. Some really believe that, and then you have a whole bunch, the majority of the Muslim world, who don't believe everything, or because most of them have not read the Quran. They've heard it preached in the mosque on Friday, perhaps, if they go to prayers. But most of them are, they really do practice this private, moderate Islam, but that doesn't mean they're truly. Now, it's hard for a Christian to say a Muslim's not really a Muslim, but it's true. They don't really believe everything that this so-called Word of God says.
Are there two Islams? At least two Islams. I'm not talking about the factions of Islam, Dr. Schmidt. But Western Islam, which is predominantly incorporated into democracy and into a Western style of life, and non-Western Islam, which isn't, and therefore much closer to Muhammad's ideal.
I would say that there are not two Islams any more than you can say there are two Christianities. And the point that my friend Francisca made a moment ago, I also address in my book. Just because you call yourself a Christian doesn't make yourself a Christian. If I were to call myself a nuclear physicist, that doesn't make me a nuclear physicist. I have to give some evidence for it. And a lot of the Muslims, I've had interviews in different parts of them from different radio stations, like many of them admit they have never read the Quran. And in some of those, perhaps this lady, may have read bits and pieces of the Quran, maybe doesn't even know these violent passages, and there are over 100 of them, and they're very clear, and they're all written in the present tense. They're not in the past tense. Most Muslims don't know that, and I would suspect she doesn't. She's probably become a nominal Muslim in name only, as there are so many people who call themselves Christians, as my friend Francisca pointed out. They're really not Christians. Just because you call yourself that doesn't make you that.
This question comes from Dennis from Michigan. He says, is it correct that Islam seeks a theocracy wherever they can achieve a majority in the government, Dr. Schmidt?
Very true. And in fact, it is a theocratic religion. And, even Khomeini said it when he took office or came back out of exile in 1979, that Islam and the state and the religion of Islam are one and the same. And one cannot read the Quran or the Hadith and come to any other conclusion. Not only that, look at the history of Islam. They have never separated the two. You see, one of the problems we have as Americans or Westerners that we try to understand Islam in the light of Christianity. Hence, we can't understand that there's a religion that evil and that it's that violent, because, again, we're looking at it through Christian binoculars, so to speak, and we get a distorted picture. We also don't know any history. For example, from shortly after Muhammad died, all the way down to conquering Spain in 711, and then, for example, up in the Battle of Poitiers in 732, which they fortunately lost, but had they not, as even Edward Gibbons says in his book, The Decline and the Fall of the Roman Empire, we would not have any cathedrals in Europe. In fact, at Oxford, they would be teaching the Quran. And so that's the history of Islam. But we, again, being ignorant of history, including our own, much worse of a history like Islam and whatnot, all come to the conclusion that Islam's got to be peaceful religion, can't be violent, and I suppose that's even true of the high-ranking government officials, as I say in my book. Have they ever read the Quran? If they read the book, they couldn't make that conclusion.
Can someone, Dr. Francisco, let's say either a Muslim or someone looking from the outside in at Islam, read the Quran and honestly come to the conclusion, look, this is a text of metaphor and spiritual import. He may have talked about making war, smiting the infidel, but what he was really talking about was this spiritual warfare. Is that an honest reading of the Quran in your estimation? Because I'm thinking about this woman, I might say to her, have you read the Quran, like Dr. Schmidt suggests? And she might sit down and read it one afternoon and say, well, yes, it seems kind of odd to me, that old language and everything, but it wasn't intended to be taken literally.
It's always been taken literally in the Muslim world. Reading the Quran is very difficult. You can't just read it from, you know, usually it goes from right to left. That's the way the Arabic script goes, and most translators will put it together that way. But you can't do it from cover to cover. You got to jump around and read it chronologically. If you read it the way a Muslim reads it, there's no way you can come to that conclusion. And if you look at Islamic tradition, the Hadith are very clear on this jihad. There's an interesting Hadith. That most people has gone unnoticed because it wasn't translated until recently, that says the jihad is perpetual until the day of judgment. Jihad is always a physical struggle in the Quran and the Hadith. There's only one Hadith report that refers to the greater and the lesser jihad, the greater being the internal struggle, the lesser being the physical struggle.
But it doesn't mean one, it's not an either or. There is both a physical struggle and a spiritual struggle.
Absolutely, yeah.
So when we hear from Western Muslims, especially in the American press, Dr. Schmidt, that, well, look, we've got this passage in the Hadith that talks about jihad as a spiritual struggle, and that's how I take it. Are they dealing with Islam as it is?
No, because if they were to read the Sharia, the book, for example, Reliance of the Traveler, has 8 pages on the jihad, and almost every particular verse speaks in the context of violence. And so when they say that it means simply an effort to improve yourself spiritually. Yeah, that's one of the meanings, and Muhammad called it the first meaning, but it's the second one that predominates, and it does in the Sharia law. As I said, there are 8 pages in this 1,200-page spelling out of the Sharia.
Let's talk finally about the attraction of Islam. Contrary to expectation, after Islam again was thrust upon the West's attention, this time by 9/11, there were many in the United States, and for some reason, particularly popular among women, I don't know why, who decided that they'd take a second look at Islam. They did, and many converted to Islam, albeit the Western style of Islam, they converted. What's the attraction, Dr. Francisco?
For women, I have no idea. Dr. Schmidt and I were looking at a passage just before we came on the air where the Quran says if your wife disobeys you, talk to her first, but if she doesn't listen, then beat her. And, of course, the translator of the Quran put in beat her slightly, I think was the term. But that's
beat her,
not in the Arabic.
Beat her lighter. And some gentlemen say gently, you know. Yeah. And, by the way, it says wives. It doesn't say singular wife.
Okay.
I don't know what the attraction is. For example, in England, I know many men who convert to Islam, they have this sort of, there's this vacuum, this, and I don't like the term, but this spiritual vacuum. And they, you know, most of these British men, they grow up in English society, a very liberal society. The Anglican Church pervades the society, but the Anglican Church is essentially a social club. There's no doctrine. There's no Christian teaching going on in the church. So people are looking for answers, I think. And Islam gives answers to everything. It tells you how to use the restroom or to rule an empire or everything in between, as the Arabs say. And it tells you, it gives you answers. It's everything.
So if you're looking for answers to life's simple questions, Islam's got it for you.
Mm-hmm. If you're willing to believe this book and the Hadith as well, yeah.
Herman's listening in Illinois. Thanks for waiting, Herman.
Thank you for taking my call. Following your discussion, it would seem that you mentioned higher criticism applying to the writings of the Quran and the Hadith. And there seems to be a similarity there in terms also of Mormonism, is that one main problem, there's no exterior corroboration of these so-called revelations having come other than from one person. And that is not the case with the New Testament. There is multiple sources, and they have the same message about Jesus Christ. Also, I know in this day and age we're having a lot of people who want to take a similar. Sounds like some of the Muslim critiques have also tried to pick up on the Jesus seminar idea as well. And I think the Pope is in a problem in that he's stuck in the liberalism, liberal ecumenism that came over Vatican II, and I think he's got himself in a corner.
Thank you very much, Herman. Okay. Would you please, Dr. Francisco, briefly talk about the remarkable parallels between Islam and Mormonism?
One of the best biographies of Joseph Smith, it's entitled something like No Man Knows My History or something like that. has Joseph Smith saying, I'm going to do for America what Muhammad did for Arabia. That book's been criticized by Mormons, of course, but it's widely regarded as a good scholarly source. So there's a lot of the story of how this so-called revelation came down to Muhammad and Joseph Smith is very similar. They both envision this perfectly preserved text up in heaven, and it just sort of drops down to Muhammad or Joseph Smith. In Muhammad's case, he was given these passages from this tablet in heaven by Gabriel, and he spouted them out over the course of his life, and then it was recorded. Mormonism is different. Of course, you have the tablets came down, but then they were lost, or only a few people could decipher it and things like that.
And then, Dr. Schmidt, by the way, can both of you stay with us through the break for just a minute or two to wrap up our final questions?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Dr. Schmidt, before we go to this break, the thoughts about how Muslim critics of Christianity have been finding some affinity with the Jesus seminar kind of
Well, yeah, in fact, it corroborates what some of the Muslims have been saying along the time. For example, they have been arguing for years that the New Testament was corrupted by the Christians and the Old Testament was corrupted by the Jews. And now when they read the Jesus seminar or people like it, they say, well, we've said this all along. You're just demonstrating, you're proving what we have said. So it's very, very unfortunate in two ways. Number one, it supports indirectly with the Jesus seminar, people probably didn't intend their argument, but it also undercuts the historic biblical Christianity. So we, in a sense, lose out in two ways. I might just mention in the Fawn Brody book of 1945, No Man Knows My History, she was a Mormon who got excommunicated as a result of that book. And I might just mention, and maybe I shouldn't, but I'm currently in process of writing a book comparing Muhammad and Joseph Smith.
Really?
About 50 parallels.
That'll be if anyone could come up with 50 parallels, it would be Dr. Alvin Schmidt. I would expect no less than 45 parallels from Dr. Schmidt. When we come back from this break, we'll continue our conversation briefly with Dr. Alvin Schmidt. He is Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Illinois College, author of the book, The Great Divide, The Failure of Islam and the Triumph of the West, and of a forthcoming book on the parallels between Joseph Smith and Muhammad. Dr. Adam Francisco is our guest as well, guest professor of historical theology at Concordia Theological Seminary here in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and author of the book, Martin Luther and Islam. Our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727. 1-800-730-2727, 505-7850. Email us during this break as well. Our conversation on Islam continues. issuesetc@kfuo.org. We are broadcasting live from the symposia at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, underwrites Issues, etc., along with its sister seminary, Concordia Seminary in St. Louis, where they're training pastors for the 21st century who need to know what Islam is. We might have been able to be ignorant about this for the last 500 years or so after Islam was beaten back by Western Europe, but it's at the gates again, if not physically, certainly spiritually and theologically, training pastors to focus upon Christ and his cross in the 21st century. Concordia Seminary St. Louis and Concordia Theological Seminary Fort Wayne, Indiana. You can find out more about both of these great seminaries at our homepage, issuesetc.org. issuesetc.org. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation on Islam. And then after we conclude that conversation, we'll be spending some time, let's see, I'm trying to find my proper button, with Dr. Rod Rosenblatt, who was here before. There he is. He's waiting in the wings. We'll talk about Pop American Christianity with Dr. Rosenblatt in a few minutes after this break.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Hi, I'm Tom Baker, regular host of Law and Gospel, inviting you to tune into the program for a discussion of what benefits you receive from Jesus Christ each and every day. Law may tell you what you are supposed to do, but the gospel reveals how your failure in doing the law is fulfilled by God Himself.
Listen to Law and Gospel weekday afternoons from 1 till 3 on AM 850 KFUO.
Hi, I'm Dr. Mark Hanneman, host of Life Revised. When you and your spouse can't have a child and have tried so hard, the blame game can be played and hope can be lost. Join Michelle Bauer and me as we interview Jeff and Anita Winter. Hear them tell how they had to deal with the heartache of not being able to conceive their own child and how they found hope. Join us for Life Revised, because life is a series of revision.
Saturday mornings at 9:30 on AM 850 KFUO.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. How pro-life is your state? Does it have informed consent laws, abortion clinic regulations, or funding limitations on the use of public money for abortion? Americans United for Life tallied that information, gauging how each state ranks in efforts to protect the preborn and those facing end-of-life issues. Josh Montes has the results.
It's been 35 years since Roe v. Wade became the law of the land. Are we making progress to restore a culture of life in America? According to Denise Burke with Americans United for Life, the answer is yes.
We have seen in a number of states such as Pennsylvania, Michigan, Louisiana, Texas, and Kansas that prudent laws such as informed consent and parental involvement do make a difference in discouraging women from undergoing abortions and suffering the consequences of them.
For the third year in a row, Michigan was named the most pro-life state. On its list of accomplishments, striking down abortion laws and legislation seeking to legalize physician-assisted suicide. Ed Rivett with Right to Life of Michigan says it's been a concerted effort from the ground up.
Our success is in building grassroots groups in our local communities, keeping them strong, and that allows us to elect pro-life legislators and hold them accountable to enact pro-life policies.
Not all states lean in favor of life. Bottom on that list are Oregon, California, New Jersey, Vermont, and Connecticut.
We would like to see the states continue to advance the ball, passing pro-life laws that protect women and their unborn children from the negative consequences of abortion. There are always more things that we can do.
The 35th anniversary of Roe v. Wade is January 22nd. For Family News and Focus, I'm Josh Montes.
According to AUL, states that have pro-life laws have seen abortion rates decline by up to 20% over the past 10 years. For Family News and Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
Why not send a high school-age man from your congregation to Taste of the Sim, January 19th through the 21st, on the campus of Concordia Seminary, St. Louis? Taste of the Sim gives high school men the opportunity to experience seminary life. For more information on Taste of the Sim, January 19th through the 21st, at Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, visit the What's New section of our website, issuesetc.org, or call 1-800-822-9545.
Here's what Dr. Dale Meyer has to say about the Issues Etc. book of the month for January, titled Visitation. Quote, "Visitation is an essential tool for comforting others in their difficult times," unquote. You can find out more about this resource by calling Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040 or look for the cover of Visitation on our homepage, issuesetc.org. Visitation costs $27.99 plus shipping and handling. The title again is Visitation.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin, broadcasting live from the Symposia at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, talking with Dr. Alvin Schmidt and Dr. Adam Francisco about Islam. We have several questions to conclude our conversation. Our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727, 505-7850, or issuesetc at kfuo.org. Daniel asks this question. He says, "I've heard that Muslims talk about saved people in heaven, half of whom they say aren't Muslims, but Jews, Christians, Hindus, etc. Do they explain this? First of all, is it true that anywhere in the writings of Islam they countenance the notion of people being saved outside of Islam or enjoying paradise apart from their adherence to Islam?" Dr. Schmidt?
I don't know of any reference where that is true.
Dr. Francisco?
Literally, yeah, I think Dr. Schmidt's right. There have been Muslims who have done some word magic and suggested that heaven's only
it's not in the Quran.
But the Quran's very clear that unless you obey God and the Prophet Muhammad, the so-called Prophet Muhammad, you'll be in hellfire forever.
On that subject, does even the most devout and serious Muslim, does he have any assurance that he will enjoy paradise with Allah?
No, unless you assume the role of Muhammad Atta, suicide bomber, if I will. You know, there's an interesting thing that the public has not been told, to my knowledge. The plane that Muhammad Atta flew
the luggage did not get on his plane. It was discovered later on when, after the crash, opened up, that he had given explicit instructions to his collaborators who flew the other planes to make sure they showered the night before, got rid of all any excess facial hairs, and to meet the bride, the virgins that they were going to marry. In his own suitcase, he also laid out a groomsman suit clad in the suitcase that he was going to be now wearing in order to meet the brides in paradise. This is an example of those few knowing that they're going to get to paradise, but the average Muslim really doesn't.
So regardless of how sincere you are, you're pretty much rolling the dice with Allah on the last day.
Yeah, unless you die as a martyr, so-called martyr. Yeah.
Kia in Birmingham, Alabama has emailed us. She says, I grew up with a lot of Muslims. The more I have interacted with Muslims, I find that Islam is a lot like Colossians 2:21-23. Do not handle, do not touch, do not taste. These are all destined to perish with use, writes St. Paul, because they are based in human commands and teaching. Such regulations indeed have an appearance of wisdom with their self-imposed worship, their false humility, and their harsh treatment of the body, but they lack any value in restraining sensual indulgence. Kia says, what I mean is that the adherents are able to seem very spiritual while indulging in and making provisions for their carnality. What's your assessment of that, the asceticism of Islam being a cover for really just an indulgence of the flesh?
Well, when they celebrate Ramadan is a good example, I think. They talk about, you know, one of the pillars of Islam is to fast during the month of Ramadan. But what they mean is not what, for example, these austere maybe evangelicals do when they fast, when they do little 40-day fasts, drinking maybe just water and juice. What they do mean is you fast from sun up to sun down, but before you indulge in as much food as you can get down, so you'll make it through the day. And then after the sun goes down, they literally, most will have big parties throughout the month of Ramadan. So while it looks sort of aesthetic from the outside, because if you've been around Muslims during Ramadan, they're pretty, during the day, they won't even drink a coffee. They sort of mope around, and you think, whoa, spiritual. But at night, I was actually in an Arabic class one time during Ramadan. I was the only non-Muslim in the room. All of a sudden, the right time came. The sun went down, and everybody just got up and left the room, and I was left sitting there. I had no idea what had happened. I was kind of new to the field. And then I was told later on that they went to break their fast real quick before they prayed, and then they had this massive party. They passed around plates and plates of food. I thought, well, that's not too austere. Not like St. Columbus dipping himself in freezing cold water to get rid of the male urges, you know.
That sounds like a fasting Wilkins style. I kind of like that form of fasting.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, finally then, you spoke off the mic, and I think Dr. Schmidt would concur. I want you, both of your thoughts on, after looking at Islam in depth, both of you, can we maintain this distinction that you mentioned before, Dr. Francisco, of Islam as distinct from individual Muslims? And should Christians or others who have seen Islam for what it really is be fearful of Muslims that they might know in everyday life?
Yeah, you cannot be afraid of Muslims. In fact, I would venture to say most the Muslims that will even engage you in any sort of conversations are going to be, generally speaking, nice people. And I make this distinction. I think really knowing what Islam is, we have to really, just like the saying, you got to hate the sin but love the sinner, you got to despise Islam is very much a threat, an ideological, political, legal, and a theological threat. But Muslims, they have something in common with us. They're children of Adam. We've been redeemed. They haven't. I'm not comfortable with, and this may sound overly pious, but you think about hell and how long it lasts. It lasts for eternity. I'm not comfortable with anybody going there. Granted, there's going to be a lot of people that go there, but Muslims are people who desperately need to hear the gospel. They are sinners bound for hell, and they need to hear the gospel.
Dr. Schmidt, your thoughts finally there?
I agree, and it's very difficult in our society to convey the gospel to them because, first of all, it is seen as a heretical kind of religion to begin with. Secondly, they're not going to be well received by their friends if they know they opened themselves up to hearing the gospel. And if they were finally to accept it, they would be rejected by their friends. And that's why, for example, we have very, very few Muslims in this country converting to Christianity because of these other factors. Condemnation in the Quran, their friends and relatives will disown them, sometimes even threaten them with their lives, for example. And so, it's but we should befriend them. But at the same time, if they're going to be true Muslims, the Quran also says, do not make friends with Christians or Jews. So in reality, when they do, they are violating the Quran. They may not know it because they probably haven't read the Quran, but that's another saying. And so when we are told we should befriend Muslims, definitely. But sometimes that's very, very difficult if they're truly Muslims.
Dr. Alvin Schmidt is Emeritus Professor of Sociology at Illinois College in, where is Illinois College? It's out there in Springfield near Jackson.
It's 30 miles west of Springfield, 80 miles north of St. Louis.
That's where I always locate Dr. Schmidt. Whenever we drive by on any of our trips, I always give you a little wave from a distance. He's author of the book, The Great Divide, The Failure of Islam and the Triumph of the West. Thank you very much for being our guest. Dr. Adam Francisco is guest professor of historical theology at Concordia Theological Seminary here in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and author of the book, Martin Luther and Islam. Dr. Francisco, good to see you again, and thanks for being our guest.
But certainly, you haven't murdered anybody today.
But in my heart, Jesus says, if I even harbor hatred or animosity in my heart, I am a murderer.
Yeah, did you hate somebody today?
Yes.
You did?
Yes.
Well, you need to stop that.
Absolutely, I do.
Now, I haven't.
You haven't. You have not had any animosity, ill will in your heart today for anyone whatsoever.
No. And I even watched Joseph Biden grilling the new Supreme Court nominee, and I watched Ted Kennedy do it, and incredibly, it was a manifestation of God's grace in my life.
So that commandment so far, Pastor Haggard, and I'm very happy for the good nature that you're taking these questions. So far, you've kept that commandment perfectly today.
So far today, that particular one, yes.
That's Ted Haggard in a conversation we had with him, some time back when he was still president of the National Association of Evangelicals. He gave a very simple definition of what it meant to be an evangelical. You believe that the Bible's the Word of God, Jesus is the Son of God, and that everyone needs to be born again, whatever that means. Well, how is it that evangelicalism, that once was theologically robust in its presentation of the pure gospel of Jesus Christ, or at least as pure as it could be under evangelicalism, has been pared down to that bare minimum and to that notion that somehow it's really all about keeping the commandments perfectly yourself? One wonders what becomes of the perfect obedience of Jesus Christ if Ted Haggard is able for even a single day to keep even one of those commandments. Joining us to talk about Pop American Christianity, American Evangelicalism, is Dr. Rod Rosenblatt. He's professor of systematic theology and Christian apologetics at Concordia University in Irvine, California, and co-host of the national radio program called The White Horse Inn. Dr. Rosenblatt, it's great to see you face to face, and welcome to Issues Etc. Does anything you hear there from Ted Haggard when he talks about, I've kept this commandment perfectly today, so far, I'm doing pretty well, does this ring typical to you of American evangelicalism?
Well, it certainly is true of those that are deeply formed by John Wesley, and most are. In one way or another, the intellectual backbone of most of American evangelicalism really traces to John Wesley. And Wesley considered his greatest gift to the Western Christian Church the doctrine of Christian perfection. And he was more than happy to exposit it any place he could get a hearing. The easiest way to get this, and one should get it in Wesley's own words, don't believe what Rosenblatt says about it, read it in Wesley, is the small book, A Plain, P-L-A-I-N, A Plain Account of Christian Perfection. You want to get the Epworth edition if you can, because it includes a whole bunch of responses to his Reformation critics. And one of the most amusing to me is that somebody said, do you mean sinless perfection? And Wesley answered, you can affirm it that way if you'd like. I would not insist on that, but I wouldn't discourage it either. It was a perfectly equivocal answer. Perfectly equivocal answer. But it really is worth reading because he is the intellectual backbone of these churches that have 40,000 worshipers every Sunday morning in your local hometown. The pastor may not know that, but Wesley is the backbone.
That was my next question, Pastor Dr. Rosenblatt, is do you think that the average evangelical pastor, thinker, mover, shaker, is aware that he is reiterating the Wesleyan perfection?
No, and you have the situation in America today where you don't necessarily have to have gone to a theological seminary to be a pastor in an evangelical context. It could be that you're really great leading a youth group, or you know your Bible pretty well, or you're great in front of people. The requirements for, quote, ordination, if you even have that, are pretty slippery. So, no, you don't necessarily have to have any of that.
Let's talk about this notion of, I want to stay with it for a moment, this notion that the Christian life really is about sinning less and less, and it really is about being able to, in some way, tangibly track your progress in sanctification, even if you don't believe you can be perfect. I think the average evangelical would say, well, I'm never going to reach perfection, but I can always strive for it, and I know I'm getting there because I'm better today than I was yesterday.
Okay, but remember, Wesley said that really there is a second level or a second experience that God intends you to have. It got dubbed the second blessing. But this is the gift of total perfection by faith. There's first being born again, and then there's working to reach this second level, the second blessing. Then, of course, his critics pressed him and said, are you talking about a once-and-for-all experience or a process? And he answered, both.
What does that mean?
Got me.
Okay, why is there this emphasis, whether they are aware of their theological roots or not, on, okay, hurry up, let's get you saved, and so we'll preach Jesus to you, and we'll talk to you about forgiveness. But from that point on, the emphasis is what they would call the real meat of Christianity, and that is the Christian life, how to live, and how to produce good works.
Yeah, if Wesley had just stayed being an evangelist, I wish he had, he gets an A in my book. Really, he was willing as an Oxford scholar, when his own Church of England churches closed to him, he was willing to go into the open fields and preach. Now think about that. For a sophisticated Oxford graduate, and he was no dummy, to be willing to go out in the open fields of England and preach if anybody would come to listen to him, that is an amazing phenomenon for an English sort of aristocrat to be willing to do that. And he was pretty good at the preaching of the law and the preaching of Christ and his cross and what that meant. So far, so good. Then he begins to write theologically. His sermons become sort of the canon for them. They don't write dogmatics texts. They use Wesley's sermons. And things fall all apart at the seams. And the reason is because of what you've mentioned. When we get really angry at something in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, if somebody happens to make the mistake of saying that the preaching of the gospel is in order to help people in the Christian life, that pastor ought to be canned. The preaching of the gospel is in order to get you into heaven. The preaching of the gospel is not in order to begin equipping you for the Christian life. The emphasis is on the wrong syllable there. Huh? But in Wesley, you find this, and you find it in spades, so that as soon as you are born again, begins this emphasis on the Christian life, every single curriculum, every single Sunday. I always refer to my friend Charles Mansky, Dr. Charles Mansky, who speaks of Rome as law, classical Lutheranism as law gospel, and evangelicalism as law gospel law. And they discover that the last state of the man is worse than the first. In other words, the same thing I discovered in Lutheran Pietism. I'm going to be condemned anyway. I might as well give up on this because I'm never going to make it. I might as well eat, drink, and be merry. And many of them are the equivalent of Jack Mormons. That is, they go from defeat in what's demanded in the Christian life to unbelief. Now, if you've got evangelical friends know that unless they are informed, they will go from defeated evangelical to atheist, unless you or somebody like you offers them the theology of the Reformation, where Christ dies for sinners, and that's believers who are sinners. The Wesleyan gets the idea that if he's a sinner, he's in great shape because Christ has died for him. Then when he's in the church, it becomes very blurry as to whether that still works.
So can you explain theologically why it is that the evangelicalism, they're very clear that Jesus is for sinners and unbelievers, but they're blurry, if not kind of silent on the issue of whether or not Jesus crucified is still for the Christian in his everyday life.
Well, that's part of why I refer you people to Wesley. Read it yourself and see if you're convinced. Don't ever underestimate John Wesley. He is smart as a whip, and he will use Scripture better than most people you have ever met. Now, it's maddening because he's able to do that so well. That's part of what's so maddening. But he's going to pick particular verses. It's no accident that he loved 1 John. He that is born of God does not commit sin. He loved the passage in Philippians, through Christ, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. He would argue just like Pelagius and Kant, God never asks of anybody anything but that he first doesn't equip them with the power to do it. That is one of the worst aphorisms in all the history of Western thought. But that's your diet. Your diet is how to conquer this in your life, how to conquer that in your life. And you get what you heard from Pastor Haggard. Well, at least for 4 hours today, I've kept the fifth commandment. Answer, are you crazy? Through the night you broke the fifth commandment and all the rest of them, and when you woke up this morning, and every minute that you've... That's hopeless.
It seems a very superficial or very thin view of sin.
It is. It is extremely light. And when you make certain decisions as to the depth of the effects of sin, invisibly up ahead, certain switches are throwing with regard to what's happening at the cross. You just don't know it.
What happens at the cross if sin is lightened?
Sure. Jesus becomes a coach. Because you really don't need that much. You're doing pretty well already. You just need a little help to do it. That's Pelagius. And if you have a doctrine of sin that runs deep, like you find in both Luther and Calvin, you're going to need a Savior, flat out.
I'm thinking, you mentioned Haggard again, but I'm thinking about how many evangelicals at the time, perhaps those who were members of his New Life congregation in Colorado Springs, who looked to Pastor Haggard at the time, the model of kind of the guy who's pulling it off, the guy who's doing it, and if Ted can do it, certainly I can do it if I try as hard as he has. And then he has this really tragic and public fall from I won't call it a fall from grace, but I will call it a fall from his
fame.
His famous sanctification.
Sure.
The people who have been looking at him as kind of that guiding star, if Ted can do it, he's proving that it can be done, that the laws can be kept perfectly.
Yep.
Watch him fall. What must they be thinking?
Well, it's very, 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 very important that those people hear that there is another brand of Christianity from the Reformation that isn't that. Wesley's relationship to Romans and Galatians and the theology of the Reformers was oblique at best. He said one time, and the only time we know that he really read Luther was on a stagecoach ride to London, 2-hour stagecoach ride. And that's where Wesley said, there is no man since St. Paul who better understands the doctrine of justification than Martin Luther. And there is no man so ignorant of the doctrine of sanctification as the same man. There is another brand of Christianity in which you'll find that Christ's death can save failing sinners. That's you and me. That we are simultaneously justified before God solely because of the death of Christ, not even because of our faith. And we are simultaneously justified and yet remain sinners, and not theoretical sinners, real ones. And that's normal. Romans 7, the close of Romans 7, The things that I hate, I'm always doing. The things that I want to do, I never do. Wretched man that I am, who will deliver me from this body of death? That's written in the present indicative. Paul's writing about himself as a Christian believer. And you say that to an evangelical, and they'll just about hyperventilate. It's the best description of the Christian life in all of the Bible. And they will just about lose their breath.
We're talking with Dr. Rod Rosenblatt about Pop American Christianity, American Evangelicalism, broadcasting live from the Symposia at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, this Thursday, the 17th of January. Joe is calling from his car. Hi, Joe.
Hi. I think he's already answered the question. I was trying to understand where Wesley took the wrong turn, and that was what I was thinking was somewhere, you know, Romans 6 through 9 or whatever was where I've been trying to understand that better, because I've heard this, everything he's describing, and I'll tell you where the guy goes when he blows it. He said, once saved, always saved. And I came out of Roman Catholicism, and I see such parallels to us finishing the job. Roman Catholics say purgatory, they get the second shot. Evangelicals say once saved, always saved. That's their comfort.
Interesting, Joe. That's very insightful. What do you think, Dr. Rosenblatt?
Well, the once saved, always saved, Wesley would never, never buy. He hated Calvinism, and that's one of the 5 points of Calvinism. Roughly, Mike Horton would say that's not exactly our fifth point, but I forget the fine points. It is normal for the evangelical to worry like a Roman Catholic every single day. Even the ones who have attained perfection, and you say, do you mind if I ask your wife for an affidavit to that effect that you have reached perfection? Even the ones who have reached it down deep, if you get into conversation, there is no assurance, because you're not quite sure if Christ's death is enough for you as a failing Christian. It was before when you were a sinner. Now that's kind of cloudy. So what they've tried to do is to paste on the fifth point of Calvinism onto a Wesleyan Arminian system. It's a strange breed.
So they've used that, the popular evangelicalism has used once saved, always saved, as kind of the cork in the big hole at the bottom of the boat. They know that water is coming and they got to stick something in there, so it's got to be once saved.
Yeah, and it doesn't come from Wesley. I mean, he and Whitfield were in it all the time on the doctrine of election, all the time, and they never did iron that out.
Well, you mentioned Whitfield, and when we come back from the break, I want to talk a little bit about that, because Whitfield and Wesley both are kind of fathers of this great revival that spread from England over the United States. And some people would say, look, the revival alone is proof positive that what they were teaching was the real powerful word of God, because after all, it led wave after wave of revival, both on the in the United Kingdom and then later in the United States. We'll be talking about that as we discuss Pop American Christianity, American Evangelicalism, with Dr. Rod Rosenblatt. He's professor of systematic theology and Christian apologetics at Concordia University in Irvine, California, and co-host of the national radio program The White Horse Inn. You can join us as we come to you live this Thursday, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, or you can email us, issuesetc@kfuo.org. And before we round off our conversation with Dr. Rosenblatt, I want to know, given the caller, Joe, mentioning the Roman Catholic teaching of purgatory, I've often wondered whether or not Pop American Evangelicalism has a teaching of purgatory, too. They don't call it that, and they don't locate it in the hereafter. They just have you living in it every single day until you die. We'll be right back.
A voice in the wilderness of American evangelicalism. You're listening to Issues, Etc.